This program is for entertainment and educational purposes and without warranty as to completeness and accuracy of the commentary or opinions. The opinions expressed are solely those of the host and not those of the sponsors or affiliate attorneys or this radio station. No attorney-client relationship is established by any response or commentary on a legal subject. Alabama law requires the following disclaimer. No representation is made that the quality of legal services to be performed is greater than the legal service of other lawyers. Welcome to Law Chat 24/7, a weekly show that reviews and discusses legal issues that impact you and our community. Sponsored by Boatler Richardson Wolf Injury Lawyers, proudly serving the citizens of the Alabama, Mississippi, Florida Gulf Coast since 1987. Now, your hosts of Law Chat 24/7, attorney Mark Wolf and his co-host Marion Boatler.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Law Chat 24/7. We have a great show for you tonight, and my co-host, Marion Boatler, just connected on. Marion, are you on?
Yes. Hi. Oops. Can you hear me?
I've got you. How are you doing?
I'm great. Just a little technical difficulty from home, but we're making it.
Yeah, we just for the listeners, though, we got down to like 15 seconds before we could get Marion connected. We're doing this remotely tonight, so it's always going to be interesting with technology. But so how's your family been doing, Marion?
We're good. Just hanging in there.
Okay. Do you have an audience with you tonight?
I probably will shortly. So right now, no, but at any minute, anyone can come in.
Well, I've got my dogs out on the back screen porch, so they won't interrupt us. So hopefully we can make this work tonight. For those that don't know about the show, Marion, can you tell them how they can get their questions submitted and answered? Did we lose Marion?
Yes, Mark, can you hear me?
I got you back. Tell people
Mark,
how they can get their questions
sorry.
Answered. I got you, Marion. How are you? All right. Can you tell the people how they can get their questions submitted to Law Chat?
Yes. I'm sorry. Here I am. You can submit your legal question through lawchat247.com and get a response from a lawyer in 24 hours. It's free and 100% confidential.
All right, very good. And we've got a
for our show.
That's true. We have a lot of questions to go through tonight, so let's go ahead and get started. I think we have one that's pretty topical. What's our first question, Marion?
I do. It is very much so. I own a business that's been closed because of the coronavirus. I told my insurance agent I wanted to make a business interruption claim under my business insurance policy. He said I don't have that coverage. Isn't it standard with my business policy?
Okay, and that's a great question. Business interruption claims have been bouncing around the subject matter for quite some time. The president even spoke about this and said he was going to be encouraging insurance companies to pay these claims. However, there's several things to know about business interruption claims. First, it is not automatically part of your business operations policy. It could be, but it's not necessarily part of the policy unless it's contained in a subdivision of the policy. So without getting too technical, we just want to kind of go through the common types of business policies. The first is what's known as an all-risk policy. And an all-risk policy covers exactly that, all risks that your business face. And included in that could be business interruption coverage. So business interruption coverage, if it's included in an all risk, may give you an avenue to make the claim. There are a number of exclusions that go with an all risk policy. Some policies do in fact exclude communicable disease business interruption or communicable disease problems. So again, it depends on the specific policy. Another type of business policy is a named peril policy, and that is a policy that covers only specific named perils: fire, flood, theft by employees, et cetera. Again, it could be the business interruption policy or coverage is included in that, but it has to be stemming from a named peril. So again, we're running into the question, is the coronavirus a named peril in under those policies? It's a very tough question. Close call. A lot of lawyers are looking at these issues and trying to interpret those. Then you have your business property insurance coverage, which could be a separate policy. It too may include business interruption insurance. So what we have here is a situation where it just depends on the business policy that you have per your business. So what I would encourage all business owners to do is to, one, if they have a copy of their policy, look through the policy and see what all is in there. There's even some business policies that include coverage for a civil authority closure, which again may be the best avenue if you have that coverage under your policy, because if your business was mandated to close, that may give you an avenue for a potential claim. It's a very complex area. I would tell people, get your policy, look at your policy, or have a lawyer look at your policy and review your policy, somebody that's familiar with insurance claims and knows what they're doing when they're looking at the policy. Some of these business policies are 100 pages long. One of the other things you could do is try to get a get your agent to go ahead and open up a claim. Even if the agent says, well, you don't have that coverage, you could go ahead and say, well, I'd like to at least make the claim. And then you could at least get a claim number and get things going. And if the claim is not paid, they should give you a letter in referencing why it wasn't paid. But the easiest thing, the first step I would tell people is get your business policy, look at it closely. If you think you have the coverage, either talk to a lawyer or go ahead and open up a claim with your agent, and then sort through everything at that point and see what happens. There's lots of litigation that's going to be happening over this. There's even some mass tort litigation, which is another area of law. So it's wide open. A lot of things are uncertain right now. Congress is taking a look at this to see whether or not they need to mandate coverage. So, again, with the president pushing the insurance companies to pay these claims, hopefully that will help the small business person if they have this coverage available under their policy.
Okay. Very informative.
All right. How about our next question?
Okay. The next question. I fell at a restaurant on March 13th, 2020. When I went to sit in the chair, it collapsed. I hit the back of my legs, it hit my back, and left arm has pain. My left arm is shaking and will not stop. The manager did not take a report. I did not go to the hospital. What do I do now?
All right. A lot of good questions in here. The first thing, the person said they fell on March 13th, 2020. So the first thing I need to remind them is that the Alabama statute of limitations for basic negligence claims is 2 years from the date of the incident. So you have 2 years to get a claim established and try to get it resolved. If it can't get resolved in that two-year period and you still want to pursue it, then you have to file a lawsuit. That's the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations varies from state to state. I know we have some carryover to Mississippi and Florida, so I'm telling you what the Alabama statute of limitations for negligence is, but usually you can Google that information and find out if you're in a different state. So that being said, the next step is, where does she go from here? Since there was no report made, there's got to be some sort of documentation of what happened. And what I would suggest is that she go ahead and send a letter to the restaurant, to the attention manager, detailing specifically what happened, what time she was there, the date she was there, who was with her, and exactly what happened, and go ahead and detail what injuries she or problems she is having. And if she has not gone to a doctor, report that they're going to see a doctor or will be seeing a doctor, or if she's already seen a doctor, just say the doctor said it was badly sprained or broken or whatever. so that the manager can go ahead and turn this over to their insurance company and get a claim up and running. But the two things that need to be done is, one, go to the doctor. If you're hurting, go see the doctor and go get your claim up and running as far as finding out what your injuries are. The second thing is finding out what is the putting them on notice of the claim. So from there, we got to get a better handle on what is the nature of the injury and put them on notice of the claim. If she sends a letter, she needs to make a copy of the letter, date it, and keep a copy for herself. That is so critical when you're reporting a claim. All right, I think we're coming up on a break. Marion, tell folks how they can connect with us.
Yes, you can submit your legal questions to lawchat247.com and get a response from a lawyer in 24 hours. And it's free and 100% confidential. And listen to us every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock right here on FM 12, 106.5.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
All right, welcome back to Law Call, Law Chat. We're having technical difficulties. My co-host, Marion Boatler, has been disconnected. So at this point, she's not here with us. She's trying to call back in to get reconnected. This is the problems with the power of technology. I do have our next question, so I will go ahead and jump into our next question, which is as follows. I had a lawyer write up divorce papers a few years ago. They was signed, but we told the lawyer not to file them because we was trying to reconcile. We got copies of all the papers he done. It has not worked. Would the divorce papers be okay to use now and just file them ourselves? All right, well, that is an interesting question. First off, if the lawyer signed the pleadings and drafted the pleadings, then I would say it would not be proper to go ahead and file those simply because, especially a couple years later, because one, the lawyer's name would be on the pleadings and he or she would be getting notified from the court about the pleadings and about any hearings or about any motions that may be related to the divorce. Plus, when a lawyer signs a pleading that's filed with the court, the lawyer is attesting to the accuracy of the information and material that's been submitted. So at that point, several years later, the information may be inaccurate, things may have changed, and there may be some different things that need to be refiled. Now, with that said, if the lawyer did not sign off on the pleadings, in other words, there's no signature line for the lawyer or anything indicating drafted by the lawyer, then they might be okay to file with the clerk's office and just see what happens. I would really recommend, though, one, just calling the lawyer back that drafted those and just asking him or her to, you know, either redraft them or update it, or if it's okay to go ahead and if y'all can just go ahead and file it yourselves. That would be the best way to handle that situation. So, all right. Well, I understand Marion has joined us. All right. We just did question number three. What is our next question, Marion?
Well, our next question is, my brother passed away in 2015, and they called it a suicide. I feel like it wasn't suicide, but foul play. I think his wife had something to do with it, so she could collect his life insurance money. How do I go about getting the matter reopened for an investigation?
All right, and I'm not exactly sure where this question, if this came within the local area or not, but the first thing I would say is this is, if you suspect foul play, that means it's a criminal matter, and the district attorney's office is generally in charge of prosecuting, investigating and prosecuting all of the criminal cases in a select county. So I would say that would be the first starting point, would be to contact the district attorney's office and explain to them your suspicions, why you think there might have been foul play involved, and then from there, see if they'll reopen the investigation or continue the investigation and pursue any criminal charges they think can be successfully pursued. The other avenue is when you reference the life insurance, first, if it was a suicide, there's a lot of life insurance policies have exclusions for suicide, so I'm not sure if that would have been a motive or not, but something that you could possibly do would be contact the life insurance company and let them know your suspicions, and they may try to investigate it further. But really, the starting point to get an investigation opened or reopened would be the district attorney's office. So.
Mm-hmm. Question five. Are you ready for that, Mark?
I'm ready.
Okay. It says, I've been with the same man for 25 years. Do I have to divorce if we never legally married? We have two kids together. We never actually married. I want him to give spousal support since I was always the homemaker and he left me high and dry. Do I have to divorce him to get spousal support?
All right. A very good question. I'm not sure when they said spousal support, if they mean child support or if they mean alimony. There's two separate types of support you can get through a divorce proceeding. One is child support and the other is alimony or spousal support if your spouse is taking care of you for an extended period of time. Let's start with the first. If it's child support she's seeking, that's usually a matter handled by the family law courts. And again, if the children are under the age of 19 in Alabama, the father would owe child support. So they could go through, she could go through the family law courts. Again, that's different in different jurisdictions. Baldwin County may do it different than Mobile County, than Escambia County. But she can go through the family courts to get the child support determined. If she's seeking alimony for her spousal support and there's no kids or the kids are adults, then she is going to have to file for a divorce and argue that they were in fact common law married, which it sounds like they may have been. Now, Alabama got rid of common law marriage a couple years ago, but since they had been together for 25 years, the court may deem them common law married. In order to get spousal support, you have to have been married first. So what she would have to argue is that she was common law married, and when she files her divorce, then seek the alimony through the court system. So that would be the two things to consider in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All righty. Well, good. Now, the next question, Mark. It says, my children's father passed February 2019 by wrongful death in Alabama. Their stepmother is not communicating with me to see what rights my children have to the estate. He lived in Montgomery, and we live in Missouri. I just want my children to be protected.
All right. A very good question, which gets into the arena of wrongful death proceeds, how they're distributed, and what happens to protect the heirs of an estate in a wrongful death situation. We run into this quite a bit when we're handling wrongful death cases. Sometimes heirs are afraid that somebody's going to, quote, steal all the money and take all the money, or that somebody's going to be excluded that should have gotten money. Our Alabama court system, the probate courts, have set up a process to basically ensure that all the heirs of an estate in a wrongful death case are accounted for and receive their portion of the wrongful death proceeds if there's a recovery. The proceeds are distributed to the heirs pursuant to our laws of intestate succession, which is basically what happens the way property is distributed if you die without a will. So in this case, the children should have been identified as heirs in any wrongful death proceedings, should have been identified by the probate court, and they should have received notice from the probate court about the wrongful death proceedings and the fact that there's an estate been opened. Now, since she's out of state, what I would recommend is that she contact a lawyer in the county where the estate has been opened. It says he lived in Montgomery, so I would contact a Montgomery lawyer to ask them to check the probate courts and check the records to see if the probate estate has been opened. And then you can look in the pleadings and see in the pleadings if the children were named as heirs, which they should have been, because that's part of the probate proceedings, is to identify all the heirs. If the children by chance have not been identified, then she needs to get the lawyer to file an intervention and identify the children as heirs so the court can protect them. But again, we do have laws in place that protect the heirs in these type situations, because again, we see situations where a lot of times people will think somebody's going to take all the money or exclude somebody, and the court really does have a pretty good protocol in place to protect everybody to keep that from happening. So I think that's a good question and a good area of law that a lot of people misunderstand. So I appreciate that question very much. Okay. Coming up on break, Marion, tell them how they can get their questions answered.
Yes, please go on to lawchat247.com to submit your questions. They may be selected for a show. They're confidential and it's free.
Very good. We'll see y'all after break.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
Welcome back to the show as we continue to struggle through the difficulties of doing a remote broadcast. I'm here at my house. My co-host Marion Boatler is over at her house, and we have Sean and Philip at the studio trying to make all this magic work. But as we go through this, Marion, you want to remind people how they can get questions submitted to our show?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can submit your legal questions through lawchat247.com. And you can get a response from a lawyer within 24 hours. Your question could also be selected for the show.
And it's free and 100% confidential, so very good. All right, well, let's jump into our next question.
All right, great, Mark. It says, I was hurt in a car wreck a few days ago. Should I hire a lawyer first or go get medical care first?
All right, a very good question, very timely. The first thing here is I would recommend that you go get your medical care first. Go find out what you're dealing with. The second thing I would recommend is not necessarily hiring a lawyer, but at least consulting with a lawyer to find out the ins and outs of the insurance claim and the insurance coverages. I think we've talked about this on the show before. It can be a red flag if you're in a, especially if it's not a big accident, you're in a somewhat minor accident, and people do get hurt in minor accidents, but you're in a relatively minor accident, there's no report of injury at the scene, then the next thing to know, the person's hired a lawyer, and sometimes the lawyers try to direct the medical care, and the insurance claims find that as a big red flag, and so it could jeopardize the claim or hurt the claim in the long run. But consulting with the lawyer is very critical, because again, you need to know what your rights are. One of the other issues we always talk about with clients is looking at the accident report, making sure the accident report is accurate. And again, you may or may not need a lawyer, but a lawyer's advice early on could at least help you, give you some direction, and help to explain when you might need to hire a lawyer for the case. I will say at our law firm website, brwlawyers.com, we have available a free guide for auto accident insurance claims. It can be downloaded. There's a pop-up that comes up when you go to our site. It gives you, it's a pretty comprehensive book about coverages and claims, kind of gives you the ins and outs, stuff you need to know about a claim. So even if you don't want a lawyer, at least understand and know the process. Because again, if you don't, then you can get frustrated, and sometimes you can do something that messes up your claim. So I would just know your rights.
That's good. That's a good point, Mark. Question eight. If an officer does not sign a traffic citation, is it valid? The question states, I received two traffic citations a year ago. I had the original copy of each. On each ticket, the officer's name is printed along with his ID number. Below that is a box for his signature. Neither ticket has a signature of any kind on it.
Years ago, an officer not signing a ticket might have been a possible defense to the ticket, but we adopted a uniform traffic protocol for tickets many years ago, and the officer no longer has to sign the ticket for it to be valid. Now, the bigger concern for this person, whether is that they received the traffic ticket over a year ago. So, if the ticket's valid, which I think it is, then it's been a year, so they've probably missed a court date. And if you miss a court date, you may have a warrant out for your arrest. So the thing they need to do in this situation is to contact the court of jurisdiction for the ticket, be it a municipality, be it the county, find out what's going on with that ticket and get ahead of this issue and take care of it immediately before the next time you get stopped, the officer may run your name and your license and find out that there's a warrant for your arrest. And these are bench warrants. Basically, you would get arrested even though it was for a traffic ticket and hauled into court, and the judge would say, you know, why did you disregard and not come to court or take care of this ticket? So get ahead of this, get out there, contact the court, find out what's going on with the ticket. Now, if the officer never turned the ticket in, then there would be no record of it, and it may have been just dismissed outright. But the court can tell you that, and you don't have to worry about getting arrested on exactly. How about our next question?
Okay, our next question, it says, I hurt my back on the job about 10 years ago. I just received a letter from the workers' compensation insurance carrier asking me if I would be interested in closing my medical benefits for a lump sum payment. Should I do this? And if so, how much should I get?
Okay, this is a very, very complex area of law. And the issue here, several things that'll be of issue. One is how old the person is. If you're getting close to Medicare age, if you close out your medicals, the workers' comp carrier is going to want what's called a Medicare set-aside trust. And that means the money they pay you is to be used for your medical bills related to that on-the-job injury. And if you have Medicare, your Medicare doesn't cover that. So if they ask for a Medicare set-aside trust, then there's two different types of Medicare set-aside trusts that can be applied. One is a self-administered, where basically you just take the money and keep up with it yourself. Or two, it can be through an administrator who then earmarks the money so that if you go back to the doctor for your back injury from the on-the-job injury, then you have to use that money they paid you in the lump sum. Now, if you're not at a Medicare stage, then the next thing is how much. And that really depends upon the nature of the injury, how much care has been received, how long the care has gone on. The questioner doesn't really give us a lot of background. What we would normally do in this situation is sit down, get a good full medical history, find out what's been going on over that 10-year period. Then you can look at some medical charts and do some analysis as to future medical costs, and then come up with some idea as to how much you think you should be asking for. A lot of times the insurance companies will open the door to these, would you be interested in closing out your medicals, but they don't make an offer. They wait for you to make an offer. And partly that's because they don't want to be in a position where they have knowledge that your future medical care may cost $30,000 and they only offer you $5,000, because that puts them in a pretty bad light. So a lot of times they'll send a letter saying, hey, if you're interested, let us know how much you want. And then from there, they'll gauge whether or not they want to try to negotiate with you and close out your medicals. So generally they give you the first shot, but you can't take that first shot without understanding all the implications of the closing the medicals. And the closing the medicals has to be approved by the court or by an ombudsman, and they'll look at it, too, to make sure it's fair. But I would suggest talking with a qualified workers' compensation attorney about this issue and how to best go about closing out those future medicals. But that is something we see a lot of and a lot of questions, especially with our former clients from former workers' comp cases. And each one has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I've closed them out for a significant amount of money, I've closed them out for a small amount of money just because the person hadn't had any medical care over 10 years. So, again, it just depends on case-by-case, but this is really not something you should try to do alone without some guidance from a lawyer.
Well, thanks, Mark. The next question, I feel like we have time for one or two more. How much
we can squeeze one in
for a small claims court?
Okay. Small claims court, let's kind of start with what small claims court is. It's basically exactly what it says. It's kind of like the People's Court on TV or any of these law show court shows you see on TV. You basically, you can go in without a lawyer and file your claim for relief with the court against somebody or some business and say, this is why this person owes me money. And the court will hear from the other side, and then the court will decide who wins the case. Now, in small claims court, you can actually sue for up to $6,000. So it's a pretty good avenue for people to go through if they have a grievance with another person or a business that so they can recover up to $6,000. There are a couple things to keep in mind in small claims court. The rules of evidence are somewhat lax, and the judges are very aware of the fact that lay people who are in there don't understand all the ins and outs of the hearsay rules and all the evidentiary rules, so it's a little bit more relaxed environment. However, the judges still have to follow the basics of the rules of evidence. So you need to make sure, if you're going to go to small claims court, that you have your evidence lined up. If you have a witness, you need to make sure that witness comes to court with you. You can't just say, well, John Smith told me XYZ, because that's hearsay. The judge may or may not allow that, and the judge may or may not give that any weight or credibility when trying to determine who wins the case. And again, when you go to court and you're making a claim, you carry the burden of proof. So you have to bring evidence with you that proves your case, proves why the other person owes you money. And then once you win your case, hopefully you do, then you have to collect your judgment. And that's a whole other issue that the courts had a client call years ago. She'd gone to small claims court and won a case, and she was upset because the clerk's office didn't pay her the judgment. And that's not the way it works. You got to get the money from the person you're bringing the action against. So, all right.
So on TV, the small claims court pretty accurate when we watch like Judge Judy and whatnot?
Yeah, they are. That's very common what you see in small claims court. It works like that a lot. So, all right. Coming up on another break, Mary, tell folks how they can get their questions answered.
Yes. Go to lawchat247.com and ask your question. It could potentially be selected for our show. Also, you'll get a response from a lawyer in 24 hours, and it's free and 100% confidential.
All right. Very good. Y'all join us back for our last segment. Remember, we have Can I Sue coming up.
Welcome back to Law Chat 24/7. To be a part of the show and to have your legal questions answered, email Mark Wolf. Details online at lawchat247.com. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Wolf and Marion Boatler.
All right. Welcome back to our final segment. We have about eight and a half minutes to go. We're going to try to squeeze in a couple more questions, and our last question will be the Can I Sue segment. Always interesting. If you heard last week's show, it was quite entertaining. I'm not sure if this week's question will live up to that, but let's go ahead and move into our next question, Marion.
Yes, this is I'm interested in this question. And it says, I saw an ad on the internet for wine with free shipping. My uncle told me it's illegal to have wine shipped to Alabama, and I would go to jail if I got caught. Is this true?
All right. That's a great question. And that's one of these, I'm going to give one of those good lawyer answers, and that's a maybe. It is not necessarily illegal to ship wine into Alabama, but you have to follow certain protocol, and there has to be certain things that are recognized. Number one, it has to be for personal consumption. You can't import wine and sell it to somebody else. So it's got to be for personal consumption only. Number two, it has to go to, when you order wine from out of state, it has to be shipped to an ABC store, and there is a form called a direct import authorization form that you fill out and send to the shipper or the whoever you're buying the wine from, and they will ship that wine to the ABC store you designate. And when it gets there, you have to go buy, and then you have to pay the sales tax on the wine when you pick it up. Now, there is some debate. The ABC regulations say that you can only import wine that's not available in our state. Now, I've actually used this. I've never had that be an issue, but I did see on the site that did say something to that effect. However, a lot of the shippers now that ship to Alabama are familiar with this direct import authorization form, and they will go ahead and fill it out for you. They'll just basically say, what ABC store do you want it shipped to? And then they will ask you, give you all the shipping information. And again, you when it arrives, you go there and you pay tax. Now, you may also be paying tax in the state where the wine originates from, but that's just one of those things. That's basically the way you can do it legally. I do know there are some wholesalers and wineries out in California that say they can ship directly to somebody because their wine is not sold in our state. I wouldn't take that risk, because I think that's getting into what your uncle said about possibly going to jail. I don't think you would go to jail for it, but I think it would be a misdemeanor at that point if you had it shipped to your state and not through the ABC store. So, but you can do it. You can do it. So good question. And I think the wine companies have bumped up all their ads on the internet now for wine purchases. How about our next question?
Okay, it says, what's the story with the disclaimer on lawyer ads? Some ads say it's required by law, and others don't even have it. Also, what does it mean?
Okay, I think the person is talking about the standard disclaimer that no representation is made that the quality of legal services to be performed is greater than the quality of legal services performed by other lawyers. That disclaimer is required on all Alabama lawyer advertisements. A lot of times on TV, it's there, you just don't see it. You've heard it on a radio show a number of times, but it's required on all lawyer ads. The question is, what does it mean? That's a really good question. That law came about probably 35, 40 years ago when lawyer advertising first started. And the concern with lawyers that didn't advertise was that people might think a lawyer who advertises is better than an ordinary lawyer that doesn't advertise. So they came up with this slogan or this statement that has to be attached, basically saying all lawyers are the same, which is quite contrary to advertising. You're advertising, you're basically saying, I'm better than other lawyers, that's why you should hire me. But we still have to have that in all of our lawyer ads. So that's just, it's antiquated, but that's what it means. Okay. All right, how about can I sue?
All righty, can I sue? This question, it says, I fell at home and hurt my wrist pretty bad. I went to the ER and they x-rayed it and said it was not broken, but just sprained. They gave me a splint and said to follow up with my family doctor if it did not get better. The next morning, the hospital called and said a radiologist had reviewed my x-rays and said my wrist was broken. They told me to go see an orthopedic doctor. I'm in a lot of pain and want to sue the ER because they messed up. Can I sue?
Okay. Yes and no. I mean, theoretically, as we always say, can you sue? Yes, you can pretty much sue for anything. Doesn't mean there won't be some repercussions against you if you do. But from a practical standpoint, here's the number one thing. the ER doctor or the ER physicians that may have missed the diagnosis did not break the wrist. That happened in the person's fall. And so the pain that they've been going through was pain they were going to have regardless. And so there's not really, they can't really sue the hospital for this pain. This is not something that is uncommon. A lot of times in the ER, what they're looking for is doing a quick scan to try to make sure there's no serious broken bones or no serious issues that need immediate attention, and that's why they tell you to follow up with your own doctor. The next day, another radiologist may be reviewing the films and see something on there that they may decide is a break. And again, having had multiple broken bones over the years, I can tell you that breaks are not always easy to spot on X-rays, and sometimes it's a follow-up or a different view of it that may show a break. But again, can you sue? Yeah, you could, but would you really want to? No. And I don't think you would ever find a lawyer that would be interested in taking that case, because again, the doctors really did not do anything wrong that caused all this pain that the person's complaining of. They simply may have missed a diagnosis, which again is not necessarily something that is a breach of the reasonable standard of care. Again, given the nature of a fracture or a break, those things are often hard to identify and sometimes can prolong. And let me just come back to, in Alabama, we have the Medical Liability Act, which says you have to plead your medical negligence claims with specificity and in detail. And if you don't do that and the case is dismissed, then you're subject to having to pay all the legal fees for the doctor or for the other side. So medical negligence claims are not something taken lightly, and they require a lot of investigation. So, all right, that wraps up our show. A great week.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marion.
Great.
Follow us at lawchat247.com.
Thank you for listening to Law Chat 24/7, sponsored by Boatler, Richardson, Wolf, Injury Lawyers, proudly serving the citizens of the Alabama, Mississippi, and Florida Gulf Coast since 1987. Learn more at brwlawyers.com. If you need a response to a legal question, go to lawchat247.com. That's lawchat247.com, and submit your question. And be sure to join us next Tuesday evening at 7 for another edition of Law Chat 24/7, when we will continue to review and discuss legal issues that impact you and our community.